The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily express those of KCNR Radio and its sponsors. All shows are independently owned and broadcast for entertainment purposes only. Readers and listeners are advised that neither KCNR Radio nor its owners and agents shall be held liable for the content of this program.
That was odd. That was odd. It wasn't our show. I was like, whoa, we're playing someone else's show. Oh, my gosh. Well, welcome to another episode of, oh, yeah, We the People Radio.
Yeah.
I remembered partway through. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape is located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they can take care of all your John Deere needs. Give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
There you are. Oh, my goodness. Well, that kind of threw me for a loop there. All of a sudden, I'm like, wait, what is that sound? That's not right. Oh, my goodness. Well, we are doing a part two program today. So last week we spoke with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, and we realized, well, we had a whole bunch of questions that we, you know, like things we wanted to know from her, and we realized we checked off, like, none of them. And we didn't talk about her book. There was just tons of stuff we didn't do. So we asked her if she would offer up another Sunday afternoon and hang out with us. And she graciously agreed. Gotta love her. It's October the 8th, 2023. So obviously the first show is October 1st. And I have that linked on the page today at wethepeopleradio.us. So let's tell you a little bit about Dr. Curry. She's the president and co-founder of the Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and predictions and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Following an influential career in academic research and administration, she founded CFAN to translate cutting-edge weather and climate research into forecast products and services that support the management of weather and climate risk for public and private sector decision makers. Curry is a leading global thinker on climate change. She's frequently called upon to give U.S. congressional testimony and serve as an expert witness on matters related to weather and climate. Her influential blog, Climate Etc., addresses leading-edge and controversial topics about climate change and the science-policy interface. And that is really where the rubber meets the road, is where the science and the climate chit-chat goes. There's really quite a gap there. Her new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response and How We Can Respond, is really quite good. I've only gotten into it a little bit, but I would really encourage you to go take a look at that. So it's Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response is the name of the book. And her name is Judith Curry, C-U-R-R-Y. Her website is judithcurry.com. Super easy to remember. And we just hear so much about climate change. We are just buried in this stuff, and we pay so much money to, you know, supposedly change the weather in the future, which changes the climate on the earth and the temperature of the ocean and all these things. And I think most people go, wait a minute, can we even do that? But they can't fight back because they have no venue to do it. And meanwhile, the money is being siphoned out and delivered to the people who, I don't know, are either the true believers or the true deceivers, I guess, maybe a little of both, on this topic. So we thought it was really important to go a little farther with Dr. Curry. So good afternoon to you.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. Sorry, I had to do the long lead-in just because I think it's really important that people realize that this isn't just your opinion. That you, like, you know, like the rest of us, we look out the window and we realize, like, we've seen winter, spring, summer, fall. We've seen it snow more, snow less, rain more, rain less. And if you're, you know, as you get older, you realize, well, tornadoes are, and we've had tornadoes, we've had hurricanes, we've had, like, all these different things, and you start wondering, really? Like, in the 70s, they told us we were all going to die because we were going to freeze to death, and then it was global warming, and now it's climate change, and you start feeling like you're getting played.
Yeah, and we're still having tornadoes and hurricanes and, you know.
So, I mean, we have opinions. You actually have facts. So we appreciate you bringing those and sharing them with us.
Well, yeah, I mean, over the many decades that I've been in this field, I've done a lot of research, and I've done a lot of analysis, and many of the most consequential issues are discussed in my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Yeah, and so do you want to start there so we don't get derailed? You know, on all the we can rabbit trail back to the things we spoke about before, but your book does a great job, and I would really like to promote it more because a lot of, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's a segment of the population out there that's going, I don't know if I want to read a book about climate change. So maybe we could make this like, yes, you do want to read it, and this is why. How about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a, you know, for over a decade, it's been at the top of the international agenda, climate change. And depending on which state you live in, well, if you're in California, it's also at the top of your state agenda.
And our checkbooks.
Yeah. And the concern that people have is, well, you know, they just see, you know, day-to-day, year-to-year weather variability. They're not really, you know, seeing anything that's particularly unusual, but what they do see is the consequences of the policies that are being put in place. I mean, with California being a notable, you know, example in the U.S., I mean, your electricity prices and gasoline prices are hugely high. There's occasional intermittent outages. It's becoming less reliable.
Yeah, that they plan. They actually... Everyone has to buy an electric car. Oh, wait, don't charge your electric car. We're not going to have power for the next. And they'll shut it off for periods of time.
Right. And this is costing people money, having to buy, you know, induction stoves and electric vehicles and encouraged to put solar panels on their houses and on it goes. And it's really expensive. You know, some of these technologies are nice, but, you know, being – effectively forced to do it, I mean, isn't very good for many people who, you know, don't have the money to do this and have other priorities.
Well, and even the solar, like solar on your house doesn't work when there's no electricity. And the sun goes down unless you have battery backup.
Exactly. You have to have battery backup. I have solar on my house and two Tesla Powerwalls. I wasn't going to do solar until I had battery backup, exactly right. For that reason. I was interested in doing this for energy security, not to, you know, save a few paltry molecules of CO2 from being emitted into the atmosphere.
How dare you?
Atta girl.
So, and the issue is I've gone electric in a lot of ways. We have an electric heat pump, an induction stove, and an electric vehicle. And all those use up a lot of electricity. Like in 2020, before I bought all these electric appliances, the solar panels were really covering my electricity use, and now they're covering less than half of my electricity use.
Oh, wow.
So people don't realize if everybody goes electric, we're going to have to more than double, you know, our electricity output. And, you know, wind and solar are just not going to cut it.
No. And would double even do it?
Well, okay. People don't appreciate that our demand for electricity is just growing. And it's not just, you know, these appliances, but all the, you know, big data centers and artificial intelligence and blockchain use up a crazy amount of electricity. You know, and all these have societal advantages, which I expect will grow in the coming decades. So I think people are underestimating how much electricity we're going to need in the future. There was a, last Christmas, there was a huge cold event in the eastern U.S., and particularly in Tennessee, and they totally underestimated the demand because they weren't aware, they weren't factoring in that so many people had installed heat pumps, you know, for heating and air conditioning. And when it got really cold, it was like just a huge drain on the electricity need, and that wasn't factored into their demand. And the only thing that really saved them was nuclear power generated in Illinois that was transmitted to Tennessee. So people, you know, electric utilities just keep getting surprised by how much.
Well, look what happened in Texas when they had a freeze event, what, last year or year before, and all windmills froze.
It was in February. It was really cold, yeah.
Yeah, they were in trouble.
And one of the things that's not really appreciated, you know, when you have one of these challenging situations when it's like it's really cold, I mean, that's challenging enough as it is, but when a big part of your electricity generation is from wind and solar, then that's another big piece of uncertainty, and it just makes the grid so much harder to operate. Okay, when you have, you know, a large penetration of renewables like you do in Texas, and they came really close to a total, you know, grid blackout, which would have taken them more than a week to restore electricity, but they managed to, you know, adjust, you know, and get back their frequency control just in time. The other thing about Texas is there was a big summer heat event, and they were worried about electricity demand. And then the blockchain people said, oh, well, we'll cut back during this period. We'll cut back our electricity usage by whatever percent. I go, wait a minute. How much electricity is blockchain using in Texas? It must be a huge amount. And, you know, we're not appreciating these non sort of traditional uses of electricity when we're factoring into the supply and demand of electricity. So we're setting ourselves up for some real vulnerabilities when we get surprises.
I bet if you went out there with a handful of $100 bills and asked people to give you their top 10 uses of electricity, blockchain wouldn't even be on the list ever. You'd go back with all your money. No one thinks of that. I don't believe anybody thinks of that.
No. So I followed my household electricity usage, you know, fairly closely. But you know, it's surprising what, you know, what uses a lot of electricity, and it's not always what you would think. Managing your household use of electricity, you know, is a decision that everybody, you know, makes and they decide what they want to do. But I have to say that going all electric is really, really expensive. So, you know, combined with the money I shelled out for electric appliances and the solar panels and the Tesla Powerwall, I spent a lot of money. But, you know, I like the new technologies, and since I'm in this field, I need to understand them and, you know, be knowledgeable about them. So that was a big motivation for my doing this, but it's really, really expensive.
Yeah, so to apply that to everybody, you look at people who live in apartments, you look at all sorts of, you know, people who rent, you know, you go rent a townhouse or whatever. Can you imagine if they had to outfit it with all this stuff? It'd just be cost prohibitive. People wouldn't, you know, yes, the landlord would be the one who had to put it all in, but they're going to have to recoup the cost somehow. I don't think, and you know, the other thing too, we learned a long time ago, you know, I think you learn really, really early on in life, somebody tells you don't put all your eggs in one basket. And even as a kid, like, you figure out, okay, I mean, you figure that out at Halloween. You never carry all your candy. Because there's always some kid who's going to come and grab it all. So you make periodic trips back to the house to dump out the pillowcase so that you don't have all the candy in one bag. And so, you know, here we are all electric when we have all these other means of powering things. You know, you have natural gas. See, it's great. Like, if the power goes out and you have your stove or, you know, your heating is natural gas, you're only partly screwed. You know, yeah. Can't flip your lights on, but you could still cook stuff and you're not freezing cold. I don't know. I mean, having that variety gives us a lot. And we can, and as we innovate in one sector or another, you know, we can advance here and maybe take a little bit away from over here. But just this mandated, we were driving yesterday, drove to Sacramento and back, and Bill's like, man, I think having a Tesla car would be so stressful. You'd spend your whole time thinking about how many more miles you had to go and where your next charging station was.
And how long you got to wait to get it charged and what time you have to be there. And, I mean, it's so much, seems like to be a lot of planning involved driving one of those. Because it's not like driving by a gas station every corner, you know.
We drove, what, like 300 miles there, 300 back. And most of it is through really open country where there were no charge. We saw zero charging stations, on our journey.
Well, California has more charging stations. Okay, I'm in Nevada, and when I drive, say, from Nevada to Colorado, I'm going through Utah and Wyoming, there are, not only are there not that many gas stations, but there are really no charging stations.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you've got a lot of charging stations in California compared to everywhere else in the country.
I bet, just not in far northern California. Up here, you know.
Yeah, right.
You've got a lot of open ground. I guess we have to take a break. I wasn't really paying attention, but we are tardy. Take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
The imperfections, I got my saliva from school. You add it up, and it don't add up. Shed some light on it too. And I'm just inches, close to the finish, cross it and bid you adieu. I calculated every combination, every misdirection, every subtle deception. Kickstart my thinking, I was lost in space, staring at a spot on the moon. Negotiating the anticipation of reentering the atmosphere too soon.
As part of Operation Holiday Salute, Reading Kia would like to express our gratitude to our veterans and those currently serving our country. Since 2006, Reading Kia has striven to be the premier auto dealership in the North State. There's always military incentive rebates on all new 2023 and 2024 Kias at Reading Kia. Test drive a new 2024 Kia Telluride today. Reading Kia, home of the 10-year, 100,000-mile limited powertrain warranty. 418 East Cypress Avenue, ReadingKia.com.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading has the perfect gift this holiday season. Car wash packages starting at only $11. They make great stocking stuffers and are excellent gifts for those who are a little hard to shop for. Choose from four different car wash packages. Buy five car wash packages and get one free. Or buy 10 and get three free. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. Quick and clean.
Easy, because I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so. Because there's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there.
Well, we'll let Randy Newman just explain that to you. You might want to look the song up. It's a it's an old one, but it's a good one.
You know, we had earlier mentioned the Teslas and electric vehicles. I read an article last week. In France, they committed a lot of money, a lot of public funds to electric vehicles and public transportation, and they had a picture of a field that had hundreds and hundreds of these electric vehicles parked. And the problem was they introduced all these vehicles and everybody was driving them and it was working out real good. Well, then the batteries started wearing out and they found out that replacing the batteries was going to cost more than the vehicles were worth. So they started parking them. And now they have hundreds of these vehicles in basically these boneyards, unable to run them, and they are now leaking. These batteries are leaking out onto the ground, and now they've got an environmental problem with this stuff going back into the soil. So I don't know. Did you hear anything, or have you read anything about that, Dr. Craig?
I haven't, not in France. I know that in China they have tons of abandoned electric vehicles. So nobody's, you know, really looked at the life cycle, you know, of these.
Yeah, and what do you do with the batteries? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, presumably the battery technologies will improve, but I'm not 100% sure that electric vehicles are the way, you know, we're going to go 100% in the future. You know, if you look ahead to 2100, a really long time away, I mean, I don't see us burning oil and gas for fuel. I mean, we may use it for other things, but I don't think we're burning it for fuel. It'll probably be mostly nuclear, and in the U.S. West, I think geothermal is a good solution. Wind farms, no. But you can create synthetic fuels, liquid fuels. So, you know, I see that. I think there's still going to be a need for liquid fuels. I mean, for aviation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly not going to be batteries. It's probably not going to be nuclear powered. But I think there's a role for synthetic liquid fuels. And it may be a better solution for, like, vehicles, cars. You know, I don't know how it's going to play out. So I think sort of putting all our eggs in this electric vehicle basket isn't terribly good. I'm sure the batteries are going to improve in the coming decades, you know, and be less toxic, not as heavy. You know, we'll see. One can hope. But right now, yeah, the batteries are extremely heavy, lots of toxic stuff in them. And the mining to actually get all those minerals is, you know, people worry about, lithium is so valuable, you know, and only a few countries are mining lithium. Well, lithium's everywhere, and only a few countries mine it because you basically need tons of slave labor, and it really messes up the environment. So you only have, you know, places like Africa and China and stuff like that who are prepared to do lithium mining just because it's so toxic. So the thing about evaluating all these technologies is that people look at how much CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and that's the main criterion. Well, it shouldn't be. You know, it should be a broader, you know, environmental issues. It should be cost, safety, reliability, the life cycle, environmental impact. You know, all these things should be evaluated rather than just, oh, you know, the CO2 emissions. But actually, to build an electric car, and do all the mining and the construction and the steel and everything that uses a lot of fossil fuels.
Right.
I forget how many miles you have to drive the electric vehicle to become, you know, carbon neutral. And even that depends on the source of your electricity.
And if you're, that's true.
If when you plug in your car at night and the electricity is being produced by coal, I mean, you know, you're better off.
Well, like they had diesel generators behind all those Tesla chargers in California at that one big charging station,
which was just hilarious.
Yeah, it's like go across the street, and then you'll see the giant diesel generator that's powering your Tesla charging station.
Well, we're just so far from eliminating petroleum. I mean, it's petroleum is used in the manufacturing of pretty much everything, not just fuel, but the cost. If they eliminated the cost of replacing a lot of these products with non-petroleum based technology. We're not there.
Oh, we're not close to there. I mean, even just steel and cement. You know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that uses fossil fuels and fertilizer, you know, and all these things. Yeah, 50 years from now, we'll probably have better ways of doing it, but we sure as heck don't have better ways right now.
Well, it's kind of funny. There are these things we get hooked on. Like, I remember way back. Gosh, it must have been like in the 80s when I was working for Girl Scouting, and the you know, the health people got hysterical about palm oil. Oh, palm oils. You can't eat palm oils. Well, all the Girl Scout cookies that have chocolate on them, as do all the other things that have chocolate on them, are held together with palm oil. That's why it doesn't just run all over the place. Palm oil is what keeps the chocolate on the cookies. And otherwise, you just get a box with a bunch of brown, you know, schwitz in the bottom and, you know, a bunch of cookies that look dirty. Like, yeah, you'd be pure as anything, but you'd be licking the packaging. So they wanted him to get rid of this palm oil, and they couldn't. They never could. It's so funny. I still look at packaging. Yep, palm oil, still on there. It's been keeping the chocolate on cookies since time began. And they never found a better alternative that worked. So sometimes, like the things that we want, even though that's not going to cut, well, I don't know, maybe that is the hub of climate change. It's palm oil. It's cookies. They've got to ban cookies. That's what we would do, actually, if we were going to be, you know, if we were going to think of this correctly. We would just ban all the cookies. It just seems crazy to me that we get hooked on these things, and then any idiotic answer, like that's got to be the solution. We must get everyone to accept that. And it seems like that's what the climate, like your book starts out with, what is climate change? It's like, yeah, that's actually a pretty decent question because we're bludgeoned with it all the time. But what do they think it is? Like, what's the actual, it seems it's everything now. Everything is climate change. But what really is it?
Okay. Well, back in the day, 1970s, 1980s, when I was in graduate school, climate change was caused by many different things, geologic processes, solar variability, changes in the Earth's orbit, volcanic eruptions, you know, all sorts of processes in the oceans. And sure, humans can have an influence on the climate through land use, and through emissions, both of like greenhouse gases and also particulates, you know, like the hazy kind of stuff, pollution kind of things. So there's, you know, it's a complex mishmash of all these different processes. However, the UN has defined climate change to be only associated with human-caused emissions.
Everything else is called climate variability. Now, when's the last time you heard anybody talk about climate variability?
Well, I've never.
They talk about climate change, and there's an implicit assumption that climate only changes, you know, from emitting fossil fuels. And I remember giving a talk. This was, I think, at a meeting of, like, related to, you know, electric utilities, owners and operators and things like that. We're talking about sea level rise. And one person says, wow, I didn't realize that sea level rise started, you know, has happened all through geologic history. I thought sea level rise only started once we were emitting fossil fuels. You know, and that's how the UN was trying to mislead you. It worked.
Exactly.
You know, people, natural climate variability has sort of been defined out of existence by the UN. And we see, you know, I'm going to say, you know, like almost 20 years ago, the propagandists, you know, who are trying to promote action on climate change figured out that extreme weather events are going to alarm people. The slow creep of sea level rise, that's not going to alarm anyone. And Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was really a turning point because, I mean, that was, you know, just the worst disaster that had struck the U.S. in a long time. And there were some people who were relating, you know, saying that warming sea surface temperatures could make hurricanes more intense. So all of a sudden, people saw global warming are making hurricanes more intense, and all of a sudden people cared about global warming, so they didn't want any more Katrinas. So once you start blaming every severe weather event on global warming, or every failed crop, anything that happens in society, oh, it's global warming, and then that allows people to just shrug their shoulders and throw up their hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's global warming. And that's really dangerous because it gives us an out, so we don't have to really look at the causes of our societal vulnerability, you know, poor land use management, poor governance, you know, crumbling infrastructure. Whatever. I mean, it gives us an out from confronting our real problems. Oh, it's just climate change. And, you know, in order to fix it, we have to stop using fossil fuels. And what these people don't realize is that even if we did manage to get to net zero by 2050, which is, as far as I can tell, an impossibility, we wouldn't notice any change in the weather or climate. We might start to notice something in the 22nd century. I mean, we've always had extreme weather events. We have them now. We'll have them in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, none of that's going to go away. And even with sea level rise, I mean, that doesn't turn on a dime. I mean, it takes centuries to sort of, there's so much inertia in the oceans and the ice sheets, like none of that's going to turn on a dime. So,
yeah, the idea,
you know,
that we can control the temperature of the entire ocean, it's like,
well, the idea,
okay.
How about,
just kooky.
You know, the climate is going to be unlivable in, what was it, 12 years.
Well, I think that's 12? This year, isn't it?
We're getting awful close to that.
Well, you know, the crazy thing, you know, like the one impact of a warmer climate is more frequent heat waves, or at least more intense, depending on how you're going to define them. But in terms of overall mortality, almost an order of magnitude more people die from cold extremes than they do heat extremes.
Exactly.
This has been shown all over the world in many, many studies, so it's not just the U.S. or whatever. I mean, extreme cold events are more lethal than heat events. So if we're increasing our heat events but decreasing the cold events, that's overall going to reduce mortality from temperature extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is a good thing.
but that isn't how it is portrayed.
It isn't.
Yeah, all this is coming for you like a giant monster, and then they can come up with all these crazy things that you have to do in order to mitigate for the thing that isn't even a thing, that nobody asks, is it a thing? Right? They get all tangled up in the mitigation, and nobody says,
Yeah, it's been like that from the very beginning. I mean, you have to go, you know, in 1992, we had the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change put forward a treaty to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change through eliminating fossil fuel emissions. I mean, this was in 1992, before there was even any evidence of warming or that it was dangerous. We understood nothing. But they had the policy objective in place. I mean, this, you know, was an environmentalist agenda, an anti-capitalist agenda. You know, we hate the oil companies agenda. It was a non-governmental world control agenda. And a population control agenda.
I mean, I think we would be remiss to leave that
exactly.
out.
Sure, sure. So this was, you know, the agenda. And so the focus was on dangerous human-caused climate change. And so we're all chasing that down. I mean, nobody's talking about natural climate variability. And nobody's talking about benefits.
We can all see out the window.
Right, right. Exactly. And nobody's talking about the benefits of a warmer climate. If you're living in Canada or Russia or northern China, I mean, a warmer climate.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, they're great for that.
They'd be super excited about that, actually. Well, it's kind of, I mean, it's kind of funny, I guess, in my, you know, if I was going to condense, when I condense it down, like, in my mind, and I sort of look at it in fast forward or like the 30,000-foot view, I think, let's see. They were hysterical. We were all going to die from eating palm oil, so we had to, you know, bludgeon the Girl Scouts to change their cookie recipe. But the thing that's funny is they're still eating it. It's 2023. Girl Scouts are still selling cookies, and nobody's dead yet. So, and they gave up. They're not talking about it anymore. And I thought, you know what? Maybe the name of the game is outlast them. Eat your Wheaties and live longer. You can watch them just fade away and come up with some other nonsense. Because there's more nonsense coming, I'm sure. There just seems to be like the Department of Nonsense that churns this stuff out secretly. And there's a group buying it every minute. We got to take a really quick break, though. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. We love her. Our time always goes too fast with her because we talk too much. Sorry. We'll be right back.
Who's to say I can't do everything? Well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with.
Christmas lights do more than glitter and glow. They represent a gift of love given a long time ago. This holiday season, join historic Hollis Farms on a magical journey through Lights on the Farm, presented by award-winning light designers at Redding Lights. Climb aboard the Haas Express Railways or travel by country-covered wagons through a spectacular interactive holiday light show where childhood memories and family traditions come alive. Enjoy a simple country Christmas with cocoa, candied apples, carolers, and a visit with Santa. And it's a very special gift from Greg and Nicola Haas. Every Thursday night, children 12 and under are free, with special discount pricing for seniors and veterans every Sunday. It's a Haas family way of saying thank you and Merry Christmas. Limited tickets are available, so hurry. Reserve your tickets today at historichaasfarms.com and make a memory. Start a new tradition with your family at Historic Haas Farms, Lights on the Farm, where they've been celebrating the holidays for over 150 years.
Considering the purchase of an e-bike, why not get more bang for your buck? Redding Electric Utilities e-bike program offers $1,000 towards an e-bike and $150 towards a lock and helmet for income-eligible applicants. With gas and car prices on the rise, there's no better time to take advantage of the new cycling connections in Reading. Join the movement to save some green while going green. E-biking means more fun, more trails for your tires, and more smiles per mile. Find out if you qualify at cityofreading.org/rebates.
Hi, Bob the Drop here. The other day I had a close encounter with my friends from Mars. I visited them a few years back, and they discovered the great taste of Mount Shasta spring water. Well, I guess they ran out, so they came back to Earth to get some more. I reminded them it comes from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta, and it's bottled at the source. I guess they just didn't get the part about us delivering right to your door. Have your own close encounter by calling 1-800-922-6227 to get some of the best tasting water in the galaxy. Pure and simple, naturally, the best Mount Shasta spring water.
This holiday season, join the all-new tradition of lights and festivities for the entire family at Redding Garden of Lights.
Taking place November 17th through January 7th at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens.
At the Sundial Bridge in Redding, California.
Explore over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens featuring over 1 million lights. Plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more.
Redding Garden of Lights, presented by Mercy Medical Center, Redding.
Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website, HavenHumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Hello, I'm Shannon Phillips with the McConnell Foundation. As part of Operation Holiday Salute, we would like to take a moment to thank our veterans and the brave men and women who are currently serving in the armed forces. At the McConnell Foundation, our mission is to help build better communities through philanthropy. We value excellence and integrity, using our personnel, facilities, and financial resources to create and support positive change. We are honored to be a part of Operation Holiday Salute on KCNR.
Casting Crowns has it right. The voice of truth is sometimes hard to find, sometimes hard to discern, but once you hear it, you recognize it. Like the things that you tell us, Dr. Curry, about all of this climate change and all the policy goals and the stuff, it resonates because you realize that actually makes sense. You hear the other stuff and you go, what? You can't help it. So tell us this. Like I'm actually just looking at the index in your book, and I understand why you did it the way you did, because It's for us regular people. So it starts out with what is climate change, but then you move into what do we know with confidence? So what do we know that's actually true? And when we hear deviations from that, we should know they're kind of coloring outside the lines.
Okay. Well, global temperature has been increasing since about 1860. Nobody questions that. We disagree about the magnitude, and the data is never perfect, but we know which direction it's been going. We know that humans emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Nobody questions that. Carbon dioxide has an infrared emission spectra, which means that that's sort of like a fancy couple of words. It helps keep the Earth's heat, in the Earth's system rather than just radiating out to space. Nobody disagrees on those three things. But the most consequential issues, there's substantial disagreement on. I mean, how much warming is caused by this additional CO2, and is it larger than natural climate variability? There's disagreement on that. How is the climate of the 21st century going to play out? There's a huge amount of uncertainty on that one. Is warming dangerous? Well, this is the weakest part of the argument. There's a lot of disagreement as to whether overall warming of the planet is dangerous. And finally, there's huge disagreement about whether rapidly reducing our emissions of CO2 is going to make humans better off now and in the future. So the most consequential issues, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of disagreement.
Which makes it difficult for the people raising questions, because the narrative has always been about, 97%. Is it 97% of all the scientists agree? And it's like, okay, you can't get 90% of anything to agree on anything. That's just silly.
Well, they agree on those first three points about the warming atmosphere and CO2 emissions and the infrared emission spectra. I mean, everybody agrees on that. But they've tried to parlay this into, through consensus entrepreneurship, to extending this consensus on these basic facts to go way beyond.
Right. That 97% of them agree we need to, destroy modern civilization in order to save the planet.
Okay, well, this is the scary part.
Scarier than that?
Well,
just kidding.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, a lot of activists said, oh, wow, I'm really interested in this issue, and they went and got their PhD, and now they're predominant in the university. There was a recent survey of U.S. university climate researchers, and something like 70% of them favored degrowth, not just green growth, but actual degrowth. They want, fewer people. They want us to consume less. They want us to lose fossil fuels. And that's a scary high number. I mean, what are the, there's really two fundamentally different worldviews. Well, there's many permutations, but there's one that, views humans as a blight on the planet. And, just wishes we weren't here. And then there's another one who, on the other side, you take humans for granted, at the top of the heap, and how can we thrive as humans, on this earth? And we do understand that we can't totally trash the earth if we're going to live here comfortably, but it's really more of a human-centric, view on the world and the climate. So, I mean, that's just two fundamentally different worldviews, and I don't know what personality traits or cultural factors or educational issues contribute to why you end up with one or the other worldviews, but that's really what's at the the heart of the conflict over this issue. People who just want humans and modern society to go away, and the others who want humans to thrive and flourish, and the more the better.
Well, but the funny part is that first group, like the thing that you figure out right away is they want other humans to go away and other people's creature comforts to go away and other, like, not their own. Like, those are the people who are flying in private jets to the climate conference.
Exactly, exactly. So it's massive hypocrisy. So I don't know how they deal with that cognitive dissonance in their own heads.
I think it's called lying.
Yeah.
We also learned that when we were children. I think our parents busted us on that one. It involves stuff in your mouth, I believe. Yeah. You know.
Well, I think another thing they don't really consider, or maybe they do, is a lot of this climate change is really kind of cherry-picked. I mean, the Earth is a huge ecosystem, and to go around and pick certain regions that have their climate is changing doesn't mean the entire system is in danger. And I think that's the way they're treating it is, you know, the Earth is going to be unlivable. Well, certain areas, I mean, look at some of the deserts on our planet that didn't used to be deserts, you know. I mean, it's an ebb and flow kind of a thing, but to think that human beings can change that, can stop that from happening, it's that we can't. We can't stop that. I mean, things are going
to
change.
Have you ever tried to eradicate weeds in your yard? I mean, even just the weeds in your yard, we can't control that. And I'm like, when you can have a weed-free lawn, give me a call, and we'll put you in charge of the world. But until then, you're just a regular person like the rest of us.
Well, you know, this goes back to the whole UN agenda. You know, they define this climate change to be irreducibly global, and therefore the solution had to be global, you know, and this leads us to the that we're currently in. But, you know, climate is local. You know, they're in the U.S., there's like in the southeast U.S., they haven't really been warming at all, you know, so.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, it's very regional. I mean, it just depends on where you look.
And then certainly in the western U.S., well, most of the U.S., the 1930s were the period with the worst weather, the worst heat waves, the worst droughts, forest fires, even the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes. So, you know, there's a lot of regionality to climate and extreme weather. So, you know, and then they cherry pick each extreme event, you know, wherever it happens over the world. Oh, it's global warming. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's the large scale ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that conspire to give us extreme weather events. You know, it's not CO2.
And how about the sun? I mean, the sun's a major driver of all of this.
Oh, sure. You know, the sun. Well, one of the issues is that the sun has been marginalized in all this, and because the focus is dangerous, human-caused climate change, mm-hmm. So the sun has been rather marginalized. We had a grand solar maximum in the late 20th century, and the effect of that on warming the climate is dismissed, all but dismissed. Okay, and, you know, it just makes no sense. So we haven't adequately investigated the solar influences on the recent climate. And there's a lot of indirect solar effects that aren't sufficiently well understood. So I think there's plenty that we don't know about the sun influences on the climate. But even what we do know, well, there is disagreement, but, I mean, it's almost certainly bigger than what the UN climate assessments are telling us.
Oh, yeah, because it was, it's been quite a few years ago, but we had Dr. Willie Soon on.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he's the sun guy. And
Just
the things that he listed, I was like, oh, for heaven's sakes. You never hear any of those things. You never hear anything about the sun in this debate.
Because it goes against
Well, it blows the orthodoxy out of the water. And the great part of it, what a bonus. Nobody knows anything about the sun. So if you don't talk about it, nobody goes, hey, what about the sun? Like, right? It's just the thing we don't talk about.
And we're fooling ourselves. there could be real surprises in store.
That we would be totally unprepared for, because unlike the companies that you advise on weather and prediction and all those things, you're helping them prepare for the future. The bad part is we as a global society.
K243CT Reading.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Americans sharply divided over the amount of aid the U.S. is sending to Ukraine.
45% of those surveyed think the U.S. government is spending too much on aid to Ukraine in the war against Russia. According to the APNORC poll, more than one-third of adults say the current spending is about the right amount. In Congress, conservative Republicans are rebuffing efforts from President Biden to approve additional assistance for Ukraine. Since last month, the White House has been asking lawmakers to pass more than $61 billion in new aid for the Ukrainians. Greg Clugston, Washington.
Retail executives nationwide bracing for a possible spending slowdown during the holidays. A number of American consumers continue to face pressure from dwindling savings, increased credit card debt, and, of course, continued stubborn inflation. Also at townhall.com, the fragile Gaza truce back on track.
The tense ceasefire between Israel and Hamas appears to be on again after the release of a second group of militant-held hostages and Palestinians from Israeli prisons, but the swap comes after an hours-long delay, which underscores the fragility of the truce. The delay happened after Hamas accused Israel of violating the agreement, which has brought the first significant pause in 7 weeks of war. Following the delay, Qatar and Egypt, which mediate with Hamas, say the obstacles to the exchange was overcome, and the militants released 17 hostages, including 13 Israelis, while Israel freed 39 Palestinian prisoners. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
British scientists say one of the world's biggest icebergs now drifting beyond Antarctic waters, known as A23A, this iceberg, incredibly about three times the size of New York City and about twice the size of Greater London. More on these stories at townhall.com.
We all know that aches and pains come with simply getting older, but it doesn't mean you have to accept it. That's why I want to tell you about a special lady, Leah from Ohio, and her relief factor story. One Sunday, Leah was sitting on the couch in so much pain, she was literally in tears. That's when she decided to try Relief Factor. Just 8 days later, she found relief, and she continued to get better and better. To quote her, she said, "I am truly amazed at this product. Like me, who after 9, almost 10 years, almost a decade of low back pain, lost that pain thanks to Relief Factor. If you're living with aches and pain, see how Relief Factor, a daily drug-free supplement, could help you feel and live better every day. Get the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. It all comes with a feel better or your money back guarantee. That number, 1-800, the number 4, relief, relieffactor.com.
Some leftover food from grocery stores that used to go to landfills now being donated to food pantries.
Store manager Sean Rafferty at ShopRite of Elmsford, Greenberg in New York says thanks to laws passed by the state, food donation programs have surged over his 40 years in the industry.
Years ago, everything went in the garbage. Everything went to the landfills, the compactors, wherever it was. Now, over the years, so many programs have developed where we're able to donate all this food.
New York's program is in its second year, and as of late October, the program had redistributed 5 million pounds of food. That equals 4 million meals. I'm Tiffany Wong.
And updating the latest now, out of the Middle East, at least 3 sets of families have been given their freedom by Hamas, and also a 4-year-old American girl also is free. Breaking news and analysis, townhall.com. Residents of Lahaina, Maui are livid. Several have now hired lawyers to help them assess the safety of their homes following the wildfire in August. For most, this massive blaze left behind ash and the lingering smoky smell. Correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
One of the residents who's been trying to clean his home says he worries about the lingering smell and whether contaminated ash could cause long-term health effects. And Daniel Skousen is requesting an independent health analysis, concerned that town officials may be so intent on reviving the tourism industry, they might downplay any negative test results. Officials have deemed most of the water supplies are unsafe to drink, while advising that children and pregnant women stay away from the burn zone. I'm Jackie Quinn.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they've got everything John Deere up there. If you need a tractor, you need implements, you need mowers, you need zero turns, they've got them all in stock right now. Go up and see them. Their inventory is really good. They've got full parts and service. If you need something repaired, they can jump on that right now. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also
get them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
.com, ta-da. That's right.
So today is October the 8th. This is a continuation, kind of our program with Dr. Judith Curry from October 1st, 2023, in case we replay this on a different time in the year, because this is really basically timeless. I don't see the climate change people getting religion any day soon and figuring out that a lot of what they're pumping is silly. And I don't necessarily see the return to science coming. But, you know, things always do change. So who knows? Maybe scientists that actually do real science will be popular again in my dreams. She has written a book. It's called Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. I saw it on YouTube, so it must be true. Someone said she's a climate heretic, which I was like, well, she's our new best friend. She must be awesome and amazing. She was a climate denier, something or other. We're climate deniers. She had a better title. She has a PhD, so you know, when you're a doctor, you get a better heretic name than we do. I forget. She is the co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. Her website is judithcurry.com, and I would really, really encourage you to go take a look. She's got great information there, and cfanclimate.net is her company, cfanclimate.net. And we've got all the book and everything linked up for you on the website. I was looking at so before I forget, what kind of a heretic are you, Dr. Curry? You're a climate. It had like a. It was long. It's kind of a title.
Okay. This is going to be in 2010.
Okay.
The Scientific American published an article. They did a pretty big interview with me, and I got all my points across. And they had this photo shoot and a makeup artist and the whole works. I said, okay, wow, I'm really glad that I can get my perspective out there. So what did they title the article? Judith Curry, Climate Heretic, Turns on Her Colleagues.
Oh, my God. And for that, you needed a makeup artist.
Right. Well, I think the author might have been more well-meaning than the editor.
True. That happens sometimes.
Okay. But
wow.
Basically, this was following, I don't know if you've heard of ClimateGate, which was the emails. Yeah, okay, you've heard of that. Well, this was following that. What I had done is I had called out, these scientists in a gentle way, and say, look, you need to be more transparent about your methods. You need to make your data publicly available. You need to be more honest about uncertainties, and you need to lose that overconfidence. It isn't scientific. And finally, you need to be respectful of the people that disagree with you, particularly when they're research scientists who have different perspectives or you know, new evidence. You know, you shouldn't just try to cancel them and insult. So, you know, that sounds like motherhood and apple pie, but boy, was the climate establishment upset with me.
Oh, yeah, because all those things are super unpopular. I know that.
I mean, I dare to criticize the IPCC, you know, the UN climate assessment and all these important people. People didn't know how to deal with me. Okay.
Get rid of her. That's always how they do it, yeah. Isn't it? Like, shut up. Isn't that the...
Well, they called me, you know, then they say, okay, well, let's just call her a denier.
Name caller, I forgot about that.
Yeah, throw her into the camp of crazies, and then we can just, oh, she's a denier. We don't have to listen to anything she says. So they tried that. I don't think it worked too well because, you know, my science remains very sound and fairly prolific.
Facts are stubborn things, you know. I mean, when you run around and write a book like Al Gore did, and every single thing in the book didn't happen. You know, facts, even though he wrote a book and flew all over the world and tried to make everybody believe him, still didn't make it true.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so it's not about science. It's about the social aspects of science. You know, who's important, whose voice is heard, who gets the media attention, who gets the grant money, you know, so forth and so on. Not about the real scientific arguments or evidence.
It's not about getting to the bottom of the issue. It's a little bit like bad policing, right? They decide who did it and then make all the investigation make that person guilty, but never really look for who did the crime. I mean, I think everyone would agree that's a terrible way to solve, yes, someone went to jail, but was that the right someone? This is just the really, really big version of trying to solve a mystery, and they've decided, you know, who the criminal is, CO2, and, well, it's us, really. I'm lying. It's us, and we're using CO2 to destroy the world.
It's even worse than that. They decided on the punishment.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that.
Get rid of the fossil fuels before they even really figured out the
crime. Right. They strapped us to the electric chair before they laid out the charges. I forgot about that.
Right.
Literally, the electric chair. Huh. Interesting. We should bring that back. So your part two, the uncertainty part. I like your title, the climate change uncertainty monster. So what's hiding under the bed with the uncertainty monster?
Okay, well, this comes from the idea of the monster. It's the interface between society and technology. It's a Dutch philosopher who came up with this sort of monster framework. Okay, and so then there was another Dutch social scientist who took it to the monster at the interface between science and policy, you know, where facts versus values, you know, how to communicate it, fear versus opportunity, and all these different dichotomies. And so I said, climate science uncertainty monster, you know, that this is my little theme here. And it's really about how we have monster coping. Okay, so a couple ways you can deal with the uncertainty monster. You know, you can try to hide it. Okay. And this is like an example of this is, you know, Michael Mann and his hockey stick, you know, trying to, you know, hide the uncertainties and squash anybody who talks about them. You know, then you have...
That really worked well.
I mean,
you got to hand it to the guy. That was a pretty quality plan.
Yeah.
There's no cleverness with it.
Yeah, and then you have monster simplification, where you get a bunch of experts in the room, and they manufacture a consensus, and this is what the experts say. Okay, so that's sort of...
That's kind of a good point.
You know, that's another thing that we see. And then uncertainty monster elimination. And this is like, well, more research and we can get rid of the uncertainties. Well, when you have a hugely complex system like the climate system, well, we do more research and we just figure out more things that we don't know. I mean, we do increase our knowledge base. But the things that we don't know, you know, the world of that becomes even larger. Then you have monster detection. You know, you're trying to figure out what we don't know, you know, what the uncertainties are. And that's sort of what my book is about, is sort of like a monster detection thing. And the other thing is monster assimilation. It's just saying, okay, there's a lot of things that we don't know. And many
friends.
Of these things that we can't know. Okay, so now what are we going to do? You know, so, and this is sort of the risk and response section of my book, which talks about, you know, how we assess risk and how we can manage them and how we make decisions under conditions of deep uncertainty. So that's the sort of the third part of the book is really monster assimilation, if you will, into, you know, we have to, you know, we need to abandon the idea that we can control pandemics or that we can control the climate. Instead, we need to work to understand and then figure out how to manage the impacts. And in a way that, you know, is we have low regrets in terms of what we do. I mean, this whole net zero thing is something that is, what I would say, a non-robust decision, because if it turns out that human-caused climate change is not much of a problem, you know, we've destroyed our economy and spent a lot of money on wasteful things, and we could have been dealing with real problems. So that's the uncertainty monster, and it sort of pervades part two and part three of my book.
Yeah, we've more or less put the response ahead of the horse.
Well, I mean, anybody who's, you know, fixed anything or remodeled, I mean, remodeling is a good example. We remodeled a house, and we got to this one part, and they had paneled the living room. They had changed around, you know, the structure. The front door was no longer where the front door was. And where the old front door was, there was a paneled over, you know, the whole room had been paneled over. Then they painted over it, so you didn't really notice it was paneling at first. Then we started looking at it, and it's like, wait a second. That other room has a part of the wall that, like, pushes into the room. So there should be a space on the other side, but it's flat. Like, wait a second, there's like a room. They've paneled over a space. And so it's like, well, we got to cut that open. And so Bill and I went back and forth. Bill's like, we're not cutting that open. And I go, I'm not living in a house where I have a whole big space in there and I don't know what's in it. Like, I want to know what's in it. Bill's like, what if we cut it open and it's like a dead body or something? I'm like, I don't know, but I'm cutting it open. We got to cut it open. And so we went back and forth on this thing. Like, do we leave it alone? Right? Do we just paint the room and just go about our lives? Or do we need to know what's in the space? Well, you know how that worked out. We cut it open. But it's really weird. Like, there is nothing that you do in this life, including raising children, raising dogs. Everything has uncertainty to it. And you cannot. It's impossible to go through your life and not address it. Like, you...
Well, you have to acknowledge it. And, you know, and people figure out how to manage little risks, you know, about being careful when you cross the street, or the more mundane risks, and this leads us to figure out, you know, how to deal with bigger risks. But when you have, like, these real complex systems, I call them wicked problems, you know, the economy, pandemics,
yeah,
you know, climate
things,
you know, all this kind of stuff, like, you can't control. We just need to abandon the idea that we can control. That's one of the key messages from my book. But there's still a lot that you can do, you know, to make us less vulnerable to whatever might happen, be it with pandemics or climate change or the economy. And so we have to figure out, you know, how to reduce our vulnerability and make smart decisions that are adaptable. You know, as we learn more, as conditions change, we need to be able to adapt and change our response. You know, and as new technologies become available, new information becomes available, we need to be able to be flexible. I mean, you know, and all of this sounds like common sense.
Yeah. But, yeah, gee, what's up with that?
Yeah.
More heresy, I'm sure.
Yeah, common sense is very uncommon when it comes to these kind of problems because people want power and control. And, you know, they seize on these issues as a way to achieve those objectives. And that gets us into a lot of trouble.
Well, but you know, even like, in my remodeling problem, you couldn't just ignore. You had to go one way or the other. You always have to go one way or the other. And,
but I think it's important.
And with this, to just pretend that there is only one way is just not. Just
okay. Let me
defies
get, okay.
Logic.
You can hedge. First, you could have got maybe some sort of X-ray machine to try to see what's in there, thermal imager, see what's going on. You could have maybe drilled a little hole and try to look in and see what's going on. So there's some incremental things that you could have done.
Of course.
To try to figure out what's going on before you took the big jump.
But you still had to take a, you still had to put your foot in it, you know, you still had to go.
Right, you had to take a baby step. So,
yeah.
So this is my point, is to start with baby steps.
Yeah, you don't have to. Yeah, change the 100% of the course, but to not even acknowledge that there's, you know, that the road less traveled, there's never one way to do anything, really.
Right. What you do is you look for the win-win situations. Okay, in the climb arena, and this takes us into part three of my book, I mean, find the common ground. Nobody disagrees about doing more research and development for better energy technologies. I mean, of course we want something better than what we have, you know, by the time we get to the late 21st century. Nobody disagrees on that. Nobody disagrees that we're too vulnerable to extreme weather events and that we should figure out ways to reduce our vulnerability through infrastructure, through better emergency management, through whatever. I mean, so there's things that people can agree on, okay? So, you know, focusing on solutions or policies that make sense, then that sort of bypasses the whole issue of what's causing climate change. We don't need to agree on that before we do sensible things like R&D for energy technologies and reducing our vulnerability to extreme weather events. I mean, these are things that make sense. So that's an example. And the bad thing is that focusing on climate change has distracted from dealing with real environmental problems, you know, like pollutions and habitats and species. And, you know, a lot of what we're doing with wind and solar is just terrible for the environment.
Yeah, it's impacted. These one-way solutions have really impacted the things they claim to care about.
I know. You know, in the 1970s, you know, when Greenpeace was just getting started, their big cause was save the whales.
Yep.
Okay? And now look what's going on off the mid-Atlantic coast. We've got all these whales dying because of the sonar and all the crazy activity going on offshore to install offshore wind, which is a totally bad, not too expensive, not to mention insanely expensive solution that just simply is not going to work for a whole host of reasons. And in the meantime, we're killing hundreds of whales. And Greenpeace, you know, is completely mum.
Nowhere to be found. Yeah.
Well, yeah, We're going to set up another date with Dr. Patrick Moore, who started Greenpeace and then left. And I remember back when we spoke with him years ago that He said that the reason that he left was because they were they wanted to ban chlorine, and he was like, "All right, that's it, I'm out." They were just fundamentally unserious. Gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back. I forgot we had to take a break. I thought we already did it. Gosh, time flies. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. As part of Operation Holiday Salute, Redding Kia would like to express our gratitude to our veterans and those currently serving our country. Since 2006, Redding Kia has striven to be the premier auto dealership in the North State. There's always military incentive rebates on all new 2023 and 2024 Kias at Redding Kia. Test drive the new 2024 Kia Telluride today. Redding Kia, home of the 10-year, 100,000-mile limited powertrain warranty. 418 East Cypress Avenue, RedingKia.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Redding and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Hi, Bob the Drop here. The other day I had a close encounter with my friends from Mars. I visited them a few years back and they discovered the great taste of Mount Shasta spring water. Well, I guess they ran out, so they came back to Earth to get some more. I reminded them it comes from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta and it's bottled at the source. I guess they just didn't get the part about us delivering right to your door. Have your own close encounter by calling 1-800-922-6227 to get some of the best tasting water in the galaxy. Pure and simple, naturally the best. Mount Shasta spring water.
Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Redding has the perfect gift this holiday season. Car wash packages starting at only $11. They make great stocking stuffers and are excellent gifts for those who are a little hard to shop for. Choose from four different car wash packages. Buy five car wash packages and get one free. Or buy 10 and get three free. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Redding. Quick and clean.
How much fun would it be the next time the IPCC meet to just like slide that in and starts blasting out of all the speakers? Who made you king of anything?
Let me hold your crown.
So Dr. Curry, on the risk side of the climate debate, I mean that's a huge list. It's got to be a huge list. What's at the top for you? Like, I guess it depends on who's asking.
In terms of what's the worst thing that might happen?
Yeah, maybe. I guess if you had to put it in some sort of, like, crazy order. Is there such a thing?
Okay. The worst thing that could happen...
Yes, there is such a thing.
...is a partial collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Okay. The West Antarctic ice sheet is unstable. If you took away the ice sheet, you know, the continent would actually be well under sea level. Okay, so it's a hugely thick ice sheet. And because it's grounded below sea level, it's unstable and it moves fairly fast.
Yeah, because it's like miles thick, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so there's, whenever you hear, oh my gosh, an iceberg the size of Rhode Island just broke off, well, that's usually coming from the West Antarctic ice sheet. And it's not an uncommon occurrence. I mean, these big icebergs, ice islands even, you know, just leave the continent, you know, with some regularity. The question is, well, is global warming making this worse? Well, conceivably a little bit, but it's really, if this were to collapse, it's more likely to be, you know, associated with geologic processes. There's a lot of geothermal heat and even volcanoes beneath parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet. If that was to become more active, that would make it more unstable. There's also the ground beneath is rising, something that's not quite understood as to why it should be rising so fast, and so that colors our perception of instability. But when people talk about tipping points or something really crazy and bad that could happen, that's probably at the top of the list. It'd be collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which would raise sea level by a few meters over the course of a couple of centuries. So that's probably the worst that can happen. But in all honesty, natural climate variability and geologic processes are more likely as a potential cause than global warming. After that, you know, I don't see a heck of a lot to be concerned about. You know, the past 150 years have seen really quite benign weather. I mean, you know, people, our climate is, you know, and all the warming, you know, the 2-degree target and all that kind of stuff that the UN folks talk about, that's relative to pre-industrial, you know, about 1750. Well, the 18th century, the 1700s, were a terrible time. I mean, it was towards the end of the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest period of the past 1,000 years. I mean, think George Washington and Valley Forge.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know,
never
really
talked about
cold.
The food or the weather.
Right. And in Europe, in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, the weather was just so bad, so cold. There were famines and just, you know, it was just horrible. And they were drowning witches because they were blaming them for bad weather, you know, in the same way that now we blame fossil fuels for bad
right.
weather.
But the bad weather back then had nothing to do with human-caused.
Oh, no, it was cold.
They were driving their wagons too fast.
Right. But my point is that the weather tends to be much worse when it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and so they reference the current warming to this very cold period. Well, you know, like it was some sort of Goldilocks climate, you know, back in the 1700s. Well, it certainly wasn't. So it's just another sort of nonsensical thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if we pass 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, it's the end of the world.
I don't want to zoom by that. Wait, is that why they think, apparently I don't study this enough. That's the frame of reference? They think everything was so great then?
Yeah, pre-industrial, before humans started influencing the climate.
And so we've got to get back to that because it was so fantastic?
Well, I don't think...
Wait, I'm sorry. How do you make a serious argument about that?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy, but it becomes enshrined in
You've got to fly to a foreign. You've got to fly to a foreign country on a private jet, sit around with a bunch of people who only think like you. I guess.
Yeah, it's not quite. And it's political. And people say, "Oh, well, it's science tells us what this target is." It does. The science has had nothing to do with it. This was purely a political decision.
Poor science gets blamed for everything.
These targets to maximize the pressure. If the target's too high, well, people say, oh, later. And if the target's too low, it looks hopeless. So it's carefully calculated to maximize the pressure for action. And it's totally a political decision.
Wow. It's as random as it feels.
So there really is. I mean, if you were to sit down with them and say, okay, pick a time period that was the perfect climate and we'll shoot for that, what would that time period be?
Well, again, climate is regional.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where are you? And how do you make that be the whole world?
Exactly. So it's, with any climate change, there's winners and losers. But why do people think warming's bad? In the U.S., people are migrating from Illinois and New York to Florida and Texas and Arizona. Because I hate cold winters. So what's wrong with a warmer climate? But then you talk about, in the Middle East, oh, my gosh, it got to some crazy temperature. Well, they know the temperature's really hot there. And in the wealthier countries, they're wealthy because they have a lot of oil money. Everything's air-conditioned, and they do just fine.
Yeah.
And people work at night. A lot of athletics and work, outside work, occurs at night when it's cooler. They've just adjusted their schedule, around that. So, this is the weakest part of their argument, that sort of warming is dangerous. And if you take the extreme weather events out of the equation, which have nothing to do with warming temperatures, you're just left with the slow creep of sea level rise and some glacier melting. And it's hard to make that sound very dangerous.
Right. Well, I remember when Dr. Moore spoke about the bleaching of the coral reefs and kind of, don't tell him I said this, he went a little crazy. He started kind of ranting. And he's like, that's just ridiculous. You can't bleach a coral reef. He's like, it's a plankton. And he kind of went into what makes the color on the reef. He's like, coral doesn't have color. It's like, I didn't think it was really happening. But after he explained it, it really wasn't happening. And I felt bad for him. I'm like, scientists must be so frustrated right now.
Corals are a dynamic ecosystem. They have natural die-off, and they have natural periods where they thrive. And most of the publicity has been about the coral reefs off Australia. Well, right now they seem to be doing fine.
Oops.
A couple of years ago they weren't doing
something. Let's not talk about that right
now. doesn't feed into the more bad news scenario. That's the funny part. Like, things that do well, it's like, shh. That's not a thing today.
Oh, exactly. They cherry pick to only talk about the bad things. Have you ever heard that extreme cold events cause 9 times more deaths than extreme heat events?
No.
I haven't heard that, but I did grow up in Connecticut, and so I am aware that winter is a little tougher. Just if you're going to look from a kid's perspective, like getting to school in the winter. We had these huge ice storms. And, pipes froze and stuff happened, and we moved from there to California, and it was kind of like, okay, well, nothing happens here. honestly, it was all pretty flat line here. It got warm, it got cool, but nothing like there.
Yeah, but it still gets cold there. Nothing's really changed in the last...
Yeah, we got rid of all of our, wool sweaters. You have some serious cold protection when you live in a place like that. You don't dare, get in your car without being prepared. Like, what if your car broke down and you had to go walk somewhere? You can't just go take off in your dress-up clothes and go somewhere. You've got to always be prepared for things. It's harder to live in those climates. It takes a lot of planning and a lot of consideration for the cold. Here, we're just going to get all sweaty, you know. Right?
So this whole notion of dangerous, you know, it's about values, and it's very subjective, and our perceptions of risk are often very misguided.
Yeah, I think your monster thing is really appropriate, because it is portrayed a wee bit like a monster. And then you have, I got a thing this last week. The Biden administration report admits green energy subsidized more than fossil fuels. And I thought, that's not shocking. But I was kind of, I guess, I don't know if I was surprised by it, but the numbers were staggering. From 2016 to 2022, renewable energy sources received $83.8 billion in subsidies, while fossil fuels received $24.5 billion. And you look at that and you think, let's see, who's going to innovate more? Who's going to be more in the forefront? Who's going to, are they going to try to make us buy more products from? You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, particularly wind turbines, they aren't economical without massive subsidies. And especially the offshore, people are bailing on the offshore wind just because, you know, the costs are so humongous and the subsidies just aren't sufficient. So wind turbines are just very uneconomical to build. Solar is cheaper. It's still not cheap, but it's definitely much cheaper than the wind turbines.
But like where they put them, you know, they put all those solar farms in the Midwest and then a giant hailstorm comes.
Yeah.
Oops. Epic fail. Goodbye, solar panels.
Now this is one of the big contradictions.
Yeah.
So the reason we don't want global warming and we want to get rid of fossil fuels is allegedly so we can get rid of bad weather.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So then they make
fundamentally
our energy
unserious.
Sources. Yeah, wind and solar and even hydro that fluctuate with the weather. We have wind droughts and solar droughts. If you have a forest fire, you're not going to be getting any solar radiation. With the big fires in Canada, apparently in New York, it really knocked out the solar power quite a bit. So why do we want our power supply
To be all one way?
To be vulnerable to extreme weather. I mean, mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah, none of that makes any sense when you delve into it. But the problem is it's almost like when the music's up too loud. You know, it's really hard to think. It's a little bit like that now with the whole narrative of this, because you're just bludgeoned with it everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, we have to take one more quick break. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and we have done two shows with her, October 1st and October 8th of 2023. I hope you'll listen to them both. Super informative, gives you lots of information to speak with your with the true believers in your life, maybe share it with them, and might give them pause for thought. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, 'cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, 'cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
For as long as anyone can remember, Historic Haas Farms has been the place for the holiday season. Memories that date back to early childhood, filled with wonderful food, music, and friendship. A place where everyone is welcome. In that tradition, Historic Haas Farms has a special treat, Lights on the Farm. A 1-mile journey filled with wondrous lights and music.
A country odyssey. To make this journey, you'll ride out in country-covered wagons or take the Mighty Haas Express. Sit back and view the seemingly never-ending waves of shimmering lights. Brightly designed by one of our own, award-winning Michelle Van Gant of Redding Lights. So reserve your ticket to ride today. Times and dates are limited, and every Thursday, children 12 and under are free. So don't delay. Order your tickets online at historichaasfarms.com. Because Christmas lights do more than just glow. They're about love given a long time ago.
The seasons are changing. Keeping your family healthy is important. So is the health of your car. The longevity and reliability of your vehicle depends on you to make sure your oil, radiator coolant, windshield wipers, and other vital systems have all been taken care of so your car can bring your healthy family through the seasons. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Premier doesn't require an appointment, and you don't drop your car off or wait. Maintain your car warranty with our service while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car. Enjoy a free beverage and Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Stop into a Premier Oil Change near you today. Visit us in Palos Pedro, in the Holiday Shopping Center, or in Redding, on Lake Boulevard, near Waterworks Park, and Anderson, across from Roundtable Pizza. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier, your friendly oil change.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Hey there, friends. RC here with Tobacco and Brew. This month, we're bringing you an exclusive and new cigar, the 1502 XO. I'll be very deliberate with this one, folks. This is the smoothest cigar I've smoked ever. The 1502 XO. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
And all that glitters is gold.
Only shooting stars break the mold. It's a cool place.
It's our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, right there in a nutshell. Only
all-star.
Only shooting stars break the mold. Yeah, you absolutely are an all-star in this field because, well, for starters, you tell the truth. That's kind of a biggie. And you do tell it in a way that is understandable. You know, a lot of times science can be confusing, which doesn't give us regular people many tools. So,
well, I mean,
thanks for catering to the regular people.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to figure out how to do that. I started it like around 2006 or so. I became very intrigued by the blogosphere, you know, which was a very big deal, you know,
yeah,
back around that time. And I started going around to a bunch of different blogs and commenting, you know, a range of blogs, from the alarmist blogs to the skeptical blogs, and just engaging with people. And, you know, I was invited to write some guest posts and whatever. But that really helped me develop my communication skills and my ability to write to a very broad audience. And in 2010, I started my own blog, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com, where, you know, a big part of what I'm doing is try to communicate in a way that works for a broad audience. I'm talking about, you know, not the QAnon types, but, you know, people who have a sincere interest, maybe have a college degree, but a smart high school student should be able to understand it, too. You don't need to be an expert or a specialist to understand this. And what I found is that a lot of people who are educated in technical fields outside of climate science, became very interested in this field and began applying their knowledge and their expertise to investigating things, and they would write guest posts on my blog. And so, you know, I was able to develop this little community, you know, with a broad range of expertise, and it provides a forum for people across the spectrum, so to speak, to come discuss, debate, question, disagree, argue, do whatever.
It's just really important because those of us who, I mean, have any common sense at all, you look at, just you listen to some of this stuff and you go, all right, that can't be real. You know that there's something haywire with it, but you don't necessarily have the scientific background to go after it. And you have managed to pull those things that the rest of us spot right away. And then say, well, this is what you're looking at. This is what you're looking at. And it's really helpful. You also have part of one of your, in chapter 11, you talk about the applications of the precautionary principle. Maybe in our last little bit here, would it be cool to go through a little bit of your risk management and your precautionary principle? Because you include the COVID deal in there, and God knows we all got an education there.
Okay, well, again,
in skepticism, I should say.
Yeah, this goes back to 1992. Remember the Preventing Dangerous Human-Caused Climate Change?
Right.
And the precautionary principle was enshrined at the Rio Earth Summit maybe a year or two before, you know, that we don't need to have full understanding, but we should present it anyways, just in case. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, which works fine for something simple, like what if somebody comes up with, okay, red dye number 2 looks like it causes cancer. Well, how sure are we? Well, we're not that sure, but what the heck? We don't need red dye number 2. Let's just use, you know, beets or something like that if we need the red color. So it was a simple problem. You can easily find a replacement. Well, what we're talking about in terms of CO2 emissions is that there's no simple, quick replacement for fossil fuels. And so this precautionary principle is like at the root of these targets, 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees. And it's a really bad match for a really complex problem like climate change or COVID. Swinging over to COVID for a minute, like when in that first month, like I started hearing about this, I guess in January, you know, what the heck is going on? And I was trying to, you know, garner any information that I could. And in the very early days, there was so much uncertainty. We had no, we knew that this was going to go global. We knew that people were going to die probably a lot. But we didn't know a heck of a lot else. So in case of, like, clear and present danger, you know, a short period of applying the precautionary principle until we can figure out what's going on made a certain amount of sense. In March when they started lockdowns and preventing people from traveling and stuff like that.
Sure.
So that makes a certain amount of sense. But by the time April and May rolled around, we started to have a lot more information, like it was the elderly who were dying and, you know, things like that. There was still confusion about transmission modes, but we were starting to learn a lot. By the time it got to be June, you know, we knew it was more transmitted through the air. We didn't have to keep wiping every single surface we touched. You know, we started learning a lot, so we didn't need to be, and we knew it was the older people. And so keeping those lockdowns, keeping those mandates for, you know, even longer a year made no sense, and what we ended up with was a cure that was much worse than a disease in terms of very adverse impacts on children who weren't able to go to school, young children who weren't able to see anybody face. And their speaking, you know, was slowed down. Old people who couldn't have, you know, who died without being able to see their families. Cancer patients who didn't get treated. There were so many adverse impacts of these lockdowns. So that's an example of precautionary principle gone haywire. You know, the precautionary principle, it's different than precaution. Okay, caution means you have to be careful of danger. Like, and we know that it's dangerous to cross the street, so we look both ways. So that's like a cautionary thing to do. Precaution is when there's scientific uncertainty. Okay, so climate change and pandemic qualify, and precaution, taking caution, even though we don't know everything, makes sense. But the precautionary principle is sort of at a whole different level. It's about really mandating, mandating a solution, a precaution, without any regard to anything else, you know, to other values. Well, people want their freedom. They want an easier life. They want economic development. They want, you know, all sorts of other things. They want to go outside. They want to travel. So that's the precautionary principle, is sort of when the notion of precaution goes haywire. Again, it's suitable for tame problems like red dye number two, but not for climate change. And so at most, the precautionary principle tells us, you know, we have a problem that justifies some response. It doesn't tell us what the response should be or the magnitude of the response. So it's a complete mismatch to really complex societal problems like COVID and climate change. And so having the global policy of, you know, eliminating fossil fuel is another example of precautionary principle run amok. You know, it completely neglects that people need energy and want energy, and we're slowing down development in places like Africa. We're messing with our food supply. We're redirecting all the development funds into CO2 mitigation funds, so we're exacerbating poverty. We're slowing down a sort of industrialization and infrastructure because of steel and cement use CO2. We're messing with the food supply through worrying about cultivars and fertilizer from ammonia that requires fossil fuels. So we're doing all sorts of stupid things that are making us much worse off while we're not... You know, we're degrading our energy infrastructure, and through all this, we're not doing anything to the climate. I mean, we're not going to have any kind of a noticeable impact. You know, like in the 22nd or 23rd century, we might see a slowdown in the rate of sea level rise, but that's maybe about it. You know, so why are we doing this? Well, because it's become, you know, it's part of the UN agenda, and now, you know, the national politicians have chimed in.
The grant money is at an all-time high. The government cheese is coming out in blocks that are too large to carry.
So you've got the scientists on board, you've got the businesses on board, on and on.
Universities.
And they're all you know, supporting, you know, it's become lucrative and professionally useful.
And in what you're seeing out there, what would be, it's not going to be one thing maybe, but where does the failure tipping point actually kind of either slow the roll or turn this back around? Like how much of this has to not come true for them to away?
What I think is going to happen is that people are going to realize that wind and solar don't work, and they're going to turn to nuclear, which is a really good solution. I mean, it takes time, it costs money, but it's a really good solution. So I think people are just turning in that direction.
And the new forms of nuclear, you know, because a lot of people, hear that, they freak out that, oh, my God, it's super dangerous, 3 Mile Island.
Well, they're doing really good research right now on fusion energy that has no byproduct, and there's no real downside to fusion.
But they can clean the nuclear now and not have the
stockpiles. They can reuse it.
So both.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They can store it. They can reuse it. Yeah, the Generation 4 nuclear power is wonderful. The modular reactors and molten salt and all these new technologies are just wonderful.
What do you see with the fusion?
Fusion, you know, well, we'll see. I mean, in principle, it's wonderful, but in practice, it's pretty much nowhere. So I don't know how long it's going to take for fusion to be a viable power source. I really don't know. But it's not on the near-term horizon, that's for sure. Technology is the answer. And once we have good technologies, then this whole political good energy technology.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.